in pursuit of oil nationalisation. The annulment of the Northern Oil Concession, Gavam's unforeseen political Achilles heel, immediately rekindled, both in and out of the Majlis, the long-standing demand to renegotiate the oil concession that had been granted to the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, AIOC. The failure of Reza Shah's government to improve the terms of the original Darcy oil concession of 1901 had left a lasting scar. The 1933 concession extended for another 60 years AIOC's full control over the huge oil fields of Khuzestan, as well as over production levels, distribution, pricing, bookkeeping, taxation, and ownership of installations and equipment at Abadan Refinery. The AIOC, which was owned by the British government, was not only a vital source for replenishing the post-war British economy, but also a source of steady income, having extended operations beyond Iran into neighbouring Iraq, Kuwait, and the British-controlled Emirates of the Persian Gulf, the so-called Trucial States, stretching from Abu Dhabi to the border of Oman, the future United Arab Emirates. The Iranian share, a meagre royalty on the production of Iranian crude, amounted as late as 1951 to barely 16% of the total. In a clever ploy, moreover, the Iranian share was subject to income taxes paid to the British Treasury, not only on the oil extracted from Iranian fields, but also on AIOC production in the whole region. In 1947, AIOC's after-tax profits exceeded £40 million, $161 million US dollars, which entitled Iran to just £7 million, $34 million, or 17.5% royalties from its own production, and this only after preliminary efforts to increase the Iranian share. There were other flagrantly unfair AIOC practices in determining Iranian royalties and other revenues, to which the Iranians had long objected. Discriminatory treatment toward Iranian technicians, engineers, and managers was another source of grievance. The AIOC, the forerunner of today's British Petroleum, ran the Iranian oil industry not unlike a colonial plantation, exerting the hierarchy of class-conscious English society and preserving a culture of colonial privilege. Iran's other major contribution to the workforce was cheap labour, mostly Bakhtiari herdsmen and the Arabic-speaking population of Khuzestan, working under harsh conditions and with exploitative wages and poor living standards. On the oil workers' living conditions in Abadan, one observer wrote, "Wages were 50 cents a day. There was no vacation pay, no sick leave, no disability compensation. The workers lived in a shanty town called Kagazabad, or Paper City, without running water or electricity. In winter, the earth flooded and became a flat, perspiring lake. The mud in town was knee-deep, and when the rains subsided, clouds of nipping, small-winged flies rose from the stagnant water to fill the nostrils. Summer was worse. The heat was torrid, sticky and unrelenting, while the wind and sandstorms shipped off the desert hot as a blower. The dwellings of Kagazabad, cobbled from rusted oil drums hammered flat, turned into sweltering ovens. In every crevice hung the foul, sulphurous stench of burning oil. In Kagazabad there was nothing, not a tea shop, not a bath, not a single tree. The tiled reflecting pool and shaded central square that were part of every Iranian town were missing here. The unpaved alleyways were emporiums for rats." The cancellation of the Northern Oil Concession thus offered two nationalists in the Iranian Majlis a golden opportunity to demand renegotiation of the AIOC concession, and eventually a call for nationalisation of the Iranian oil industry. The policy of negative equilibrium, set forth as early as 1946, was favoured by Mossadegh, his close colleague Hossein Maki and their cohorts, as well as by the Tudeh, which nevertheless was furious over the cancellation of the Northern Oil Concession. With negative equilibrium, the nationalists aimed to cancel unfair privileges of both powers and to preserve Iran's precarious balance in an increasingly polarizing world. Stalin's gradual abandonment of the idea of an Iranian oil concession, apparently because of new prospects in Western Siberian oil reserves, further helped Iranian nationalists in their quest. Demands for better terms and eventually for nationalisation, also coincided with the decolonisation of the post-war era, and no doubt were boosted by it. The end to nearly two centuries of British colonial presence in India, and the eventual victory of the Indian nationalist movement, was cherished by the Iranians, who for long had been mindful of the British power to the east. Yet Indian independence in July 1947 came with the painful experience of partition and the rise of the adversarial nations of India and Pakistan, an event coinciding in November 1947 with the partition of Mandatory Palestine and the emergence of the State of Israel, despite Arab-Palestinian protests. Receiving wide coverage in the Iranian press, these events added to the already tense relations with AIOC and mounting resentment toward the Old Lion of the British Empire, or as the Iranian press portrayed it, the Old Fox. Partitions in Palestine and India were seen as British ploys to divide and prolong colonial rule in a new disguise, in the same way that AIOC was exploiting the fractured Iranian polity for its own benefits. Suspicion and distrust toward Britain thus bordered on open hostility. From the 1930s onwards, oil was no longer seen by the majority of Iranians just as a thick black material extracted from the underground by Farangis in the midst of the remote southern Bakhtiari Mountains and then exported through the distant shores of the Persian Gulf. Now, the Iranian oil was something connected to Iranians' everyday lives, from the kerosene they put into their lamps to the gasoline that was needed for buses and trucks. Now they felt intensely that their national wealth was being excessively pumped out from under their feet at frivolous prices and shipped away to distant lands in order to secure the prosperity and well-being of powerful nations at the expense of their poverty and disempowerment. Besides being an issue of Iran's moral right over its own resources, the demand for higher oil income became an urgent national cause, given the fall in other sources of state revenue. Income from direct and indirect taxation, and customs and excise taxes, all diminished because of the post-war economic downturn. Over a quarter of a century, the Iranian state, and to an increasing degree the Iranian economy, became heavily reliant on oil revenue for reorganizing its armed forces, and later for financing its growing bureaucracy and public works. Even more so, this was the case after World War II. U.S. military aid after 1943 only partially helped the growing deficit, and U.S. loans, promised in the late 1940s and early 1950s, did not materialize until after 1953. Enamored of the then popular idea of the state as agent of economic development, Iranian nationalists considered oil revenue the only key to industrial and infrastructural transformation. The left hoped to replicate the Soviet-planned economy, whereas the pro-Western tendencies relied on the American model of development, as articulated by the Roosevelt administration. The Iranian state sought an almost complete monopoly over oil income as a pragmatic means to achieve these objectives. The increase in oil revenue since the 1920s, though impressive at first glance, was deceiving. While Iran's crude production increased nearly fivefold to 31,000 long tons daily, equal to 252,500 barrels, between 1941 and 1950, its fixed royalties of 16%, a paltry one-sixth of the total AIOC income of £100 million, about $400 million, was cancelled by near hyperinflation of the post-war years. The Iranians naturally felt the British government was not negotiating in good faith for better terms for Iran. The British public, in contrast, demanded that its government, then led by the Labour Party under Clement Attlee, compensate them for their sacrifices and hardships during the war and uphold the overseas interests crucial to the recovery of their nation. This was in clear contrast to demands for Iranian nationalisation, as in 1956, the British public opinion was diametrically opposed to Egypt's demand for nationalisation of the Suez Canal. Even though the Labour government at the time was nationalising major British industries, including coal and the railroad, the rationale for nationalisation was barely extended to investments abroad. Even Labour's leniency toward Iran at the outset of negotiations was countered by AIOC's rigidity, even hostility, toward Iranian demands, which remained unresolved. Power scrambles and missed chances. The oil negotiations only deepened Iran's political divide, which by now was conditioned by Cold War rivalries. Whether directly or by proxy, a multi-party scramble between 1949 and 1951 involved ambitious army generals, Mohammad Reza Shah and the royal court, conservative statesmen, the Tudeh party and its sympathizers, the politicized clergy who were returning to the political stage, their affiliated Islamist organizations, and liberal nationalists and their diverse allies who were organized under the umbrella of the National Front, Jebheye Meli. In January 1949, a renewed call in the Majlis for the nationalization of Iran's oil industry added fresh momentum to the anti-British sentiments. Though not entirely unprecedented, the Majlis debate energized the minority deputies, led by Mohammad Mossadegh, pressing the government to negotiate a new deal with AIOC. Less than a month later, in a tense environment of polarized politics and short-lived alliances, an unsuccessful assassination attempt was carried out against the Shah by a presumed Tudeh sympathizer. The Shah, who was attending a public event at Tehran University, escaped major injuries, but the incident offered a chance for forces supporting the Shah to declare the Tudeh party illegal, arrest its leadership, some of its members appeared to be involved in the plot, and start a nationwide crackdown on the left. Soon after, the Shah, who exploited the incident to gain a greater say in domestic affairs and presumably to defuse maverick factionalism in the Majlis, demanded the revision of the constitution so as to provide him with a new royal prerogative. In July 1949, a hastily convened Constituent Assembly amended Article 48 of the 1906 to 1907 Constitution, thus granting new constitutional powers to the Shah to dissolve the Majlis at his discretion, but on the condition that a new election be held within the following 6 months. This victory for Mohammad Reza Shah was doubtless achieved with some level of support from the populace, tired of political skirmishes and skullduggery in and out of the Majlis. If the amendment to the constitution was clearly in the Shah's favour, the rapidly changing political climate was not. With frequent street demonstrations becoming an effective tool of the Tudeh, and with pro-Mossadegh advocates taking the upper hand in the press and behind the podium, the election of the 16th Majlis was bound to become the focal point of nationalist opposition to the status quo. Protesting the rigged election, which favoured conservative candidates, mostly of the landowning classes, a coalition of nationalist deputies, headed by Mossadegh, took advantage of the new constitutional amendment and demanded that the Shah cancel the old election and order a new one. At the outset, this proved a futile manoeuvre, even after Mossadegh and his allies took a prolonged sanctuary, Bast, in the royal palace. Yet a few months later, the Shah succumbed to public pressure and ordered a new election only in the capital. In January 1950, when the Tehran electorate went to the polls, Mossadegh and candidates of the National Front gained the highest number of votes, a starting point for a process that eventually brought Mossadegh to the office of Prime Minister. The tacit alignment of the Shah with the National Front, however, was ephemeral and largely a reaction to both the growth of Tudeh and the rise of General Razmara as the new strongman of the armed forces. General Haj Ali Razmara's premiership in June 1950 came in the wake of many months of political turmoil and changes or reshuffling in the weak cabinets. A rising star of the Iranian army, Razmara was a French-educated field officer who served throughout Iran in various capacities in the military and was popular among the lower ranks. He was the key officer in recapturing Azerbaijan in 1946, and at the age of 47, he had become Iran's youngest chief of staff. Ambitious, disciplined, and politically astute, he had married up in the nobility. While reaching an understanding with the Tudeh party, Razmara nurtured some support among conservatives, which allowed him to keep the Shah at bay for a while and try to rein in the National Front on the crucial issue of oil negotiations with AIOC. He had the blessing of the United States, which saw him as a bulwark against both communism and the reactionaries, and had promised him much-needed financial aid. He had the confidence of Britain in settling the oil crisis, at least at the outset, and was on good terms with the Soviet Union, which was heartened by his soft handling of the Tudeh. For a moment, it seemed that he had mastered the most volatile stage, 4 years after Gavam's coalition government had brought a semblance of political stability to the country. Siding with the moderates, Razmara backed the supplemental agreement, a proposal negotiated earlier with the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, and was before the Majlis since July 1949. It offered Iran better terms, but fell far short of the demands set forth by the Iranian nationalists and backed by the popular press. He soon realized that the supplemental agreement had no chance in the face of fierce opposition from the National Front. Nor were the AIOC's negotiators willing to offer better terms. Loyal to the colonial mentality of the time, the AIOC executives, and the British civil servants who backed them in London, came up with the ingenious idea of holding the Iranian government in breach of the 1933 agreement, a concession that the British government had earlier almost imposed on Reza Shah and his Minister of Finance, Hassan Taghizadeh. Furthermore, the AIOC condescendingly viewed Iranian subordinates in its employment as incapable of holding managerial posts and unable to grasp the company's bookkeeping, which the Iranians viewed as shady and full of dishonest accounting practices. It, moreover, brazenly defended its treatment of the Iranian workforce. Stubborn and short-sighted, almost cynical, it turned a deaf ear to Razmara's repeated pleas and to the United States' mediation efforts behind the scene. The US interest in the negotiations was perceived by AIOC as likely to allow Americans an eventual foothold in the Iranian oil industry. American oil companies, themselves not models of fairness and integrity, had negotiated new contracts with the government of Venezuela on a 50-50 profit-sharing basis, and in 1950 they were about to do the same with Saudi Arabia, where Aramco, a conglomerate of giant American oil companies, had been operating since 1933. Aramco had received, in exchange for the 50-50 deal with Saudi Arabia, a 50% tax break from US Congress, known as the Golden Gimmick. The AIOC refused to consider any of that, and quietly urged the Americans to keep the Saudi deal a secret until the Iranians agreed to their far less favourable terms. By November 1950, when the Majlis finally rejected the supplemental agreement, the reluctant AIOC began to entertain similar terms of 50-50 profit-sharing, which, as it turned out, was too late. Despite signs of earlier moderation, the Majlis Oil Committee, chaired by Mohammad Mossadegh, was no longer interested in anything short of full ownership of Iran's oil industry. Razmara recognized the eventuality of nationalization and the potentials of public enthusiasm aroused by months of debates in and out of the Majlis. He argued that Iran was technically and financially unprepared to take over the giant oil industry, and instead suggested that it was more realistic to adopt a gradualist approach toward nationalization. Yet the firebrands within the National Front, and Mossadegh himself, were in no mood to back down from the rhetoric and give Razmara a chance. They accused him instead of financial corruption, hounding the press, and being a British lackey, and a traitor who deserved to be eliminated. Razmara's proposed decentralization program also met with disapproval from the National Front, even though the Constitution envisaged the popularly elected provincial councils as the basis for a less centralized political arrangement. His plan was labeled by his opponents as a conspiracy to partition Iran. Razmara's anti-corruption campaign, to rid the country of the inept officialdom, and, more important, his proposed land reform, faced resistance from the landowning deputies in the Majlis. Curbing the influence of the royal court functionaries equally angered the Shah. The press, moreover, damaged his moral standing by hinting at his secret liaisons. The Tudeh party, too, whose leadership had escaped prison and fled to exile in the Soviet Union, allegedly with the help of Razmara's pro-Tudeh officers, were no kinder to the Premier, and even branded him an agent of American imperialism. In reality, Razmara's foreign policy parted ways with the Americans' patronizing support, and even went so far as to end the US military aid program and abort reconnaissance flights over the Soviet border. In March 1951, still at the political helm and determined to resolve the oil dispute, Razmara was assassinated by Khalil Tahmasbi, a member of the Fedayeen-e-Islam, those who sacrifice themselves for Islam, terrorist organization, when he was attending a memorial in a Tehran mosque. The assassin was loyal to the Speaker of the Majlis, Ayatollah Abul Qasem Kashani, 1877 to 1962, and to the maverick politician Muzaffar Bagai, a Majlis deputy and ranking member of the National Front who had a checkered past. Other members of the National Front were also accused of involvement. Whether the assassination was the work of a deranged mind, or, more likely, triggered by Razmara's personal feud with Kashani, who was bitter over having been temporarily exiled by Razmara after the attempt against the Shah's life, remains a matter of speculation. The Iranian narrative often downplayed Razmara's assassination, for if he was not demonized as a foreign agent, he was considered a potential dictator in the model of Reza Khan. His removal benefited both the Shah, who was afraid of his energetic general, and the National Front, at a time when quarrels over oil nationalization had reached a new height. 2 weeks after Razmara's assassination, on the evening of the Nowruz celebration, March the 20th, 1951, the oil nationalization bill passed the Majlis after more than 2 years of heated debate. Vast popular support for Mossadegh in rallies and in the press was a sign of a clear public mandate. The absence of a balancing force, such as Razmara, also triggered a massive anti-AIOC strike throughout the oil industry, organized by the Tudeh party. It turned violent and cost many lives. Both events promised more conflicts, domestically and internationally. The rise to prominence of Ayatollah Kashani as an ally of the National Front and Speaker of the Majlis registered a turning point, for it signalled the end of clergy's political isolation under Reza Khan. As an activist leader, he should be seen as the historical link between Modares, a generation earlier, and Ayatollah Khomeini, a generation later. After returning from exile in Beirut at the Sheikh's personal urging, Kashani not only had gained a new accolade, but also had added a new element of Islamic radicalism to the public space. As a result, the Fedayeen-e-Islam, his implicit allies, acquired greater acceptance in the political fold. Abul Qasem Kashani emerged ahead, trained in Najaf in the late 1910s, had earned his prestige by his politics rather than his scholarly record. Witness to the British occupation of southern Iraq during World War I, in 1919 he was sentenced to death in absentia by the British mandatory authorities for his part in the Iraqi Shi'i revolt. Fleeing to Iran, he became a protege of Hassan Modares and stood with him against Reza Khan's 1924 proposed republic. Shortly afterward, however, when he was elected to the Constituent Assembly that abolished the Qajar dynasty, he voted in favour of Pahlavi rule and remained on amiable terms with Reza Shah. During World War II, he was arrested by the British occupying forces in Iran on charges of harbouring pro-Nazi sentiments and was sent into exile. Soon after his return, a few years later, he rose to prominence, first by organizing a contingent of Iranian volunteers to the Arab-Israeli War in 1948, and afterward as the patron of the Fedayeen-e-Islam. Naming Razmara an infidel whose blood was to be shed, his pronouncement acted as a virtual fatwa, emboldening the Fedayeen to murder the premier. As an influential cleric, Kashani appealed to the National Front, for he mustered large crowds of the lower middle classes and the bazaar merchants in support of the nationalist cause. Later, as the Speaker of the Majlis, he proved only partially committed to the National Front's programme, and soon after became something of a liability for Mossadegh. By 1953, he had abandoned the National Front altogether, and implicitly defected to the Shah's camp, a glaring shift of loyalty to be followed by most members of the clergy. Rumoured to be colluding with the AIOC representatives, his turnaround was a major blow to the nationalist cause. As tactical allies of Kashani, the Fedayeen-e-Islam, a small but effective semi-clandestine militant group, routinely resorted to terror, intimidation and assassination of the enemies of Islam. Their utopian Islamic order was disciplined by a strict reading of the Sharia, and they shared characteristics with advocates of Salafism. The Fadayans founder and leader, who chose the nostalgic pseudonym Nawab-e-Safavi, or Prince of the Safavid House, was a maladapted seminarian in Qom who once was an AIOC employee in Abadan. He was no doubt inspired by Ikhwan al-Muslimin, Society of Muslim Brothers, in Egypt, and, like that group's founder, Hassan al-Banna, nursed anti-colonial sentiments after having worked in a British-controlled environment. Like the Ikhwan, the Iranian Fadayan tried to build a hierarchical network of devotees. Their use of the term Fadai, one who sacrifices his life for a cause, may have been inspired by memories of the 12th century Ismailis of the Alamut and legend of the Assassins, but in practice it was modelled after the Ikhwan's hierarchy. A disturbing development of the post-war era, the Fadayan, nearly all laymen with backgrounds in the bazaar, were intolerant of both secular society and critics of Islamic Sharia as interpreted by mainstream clergy. In 1946, they assassinated Ahmad Khasravi for his disparaging remarks about Shiism. In 1949, they killed the minister of the royal court, Abd al-Hussein Hazhir, 1902-1949, a capable statesman and ally of the Shah, presumably on charges of irreligious conduct and selling out to foreign interests. To achieve their ultimate goal of establishing an Islamic government, however, the Fadayan were willing to form tactical alliances even with members of the National Front or the Pahlavi court. Their radical convictions led to their eventual destruction, however, when in 1955 Nawab-e-Safavi and two of his lieutenants were executed after a failed assassination attempt against the Prime Minister Hossein Alla, 1884-1964, a statesman of some integrity from the Qajar nobility who was viewed as an Anglophile. Their memory lingered and inspired others in later generations, and especially among the activists of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Mossadegh and politics of protest. After an interregnum of an interim government and weeks of negotiations with the Shah, on April 28, 1951, Mohammad Mossadegh was appointed the new prime minister. He had received 79 votes of confidence out of the total of 91 Majlis deputies present on the voting day. The leader of the National Front and one of the most eminent deputies in the whole life of the Majlis, Mossadegh was hailed as the defender of national sovereignty, constitutional rights, free and fair elections, and above all a champion of the oil nationalisation campaign. His long career of more than half a century distinguished him as an ardent liberal, a seasoned parliamentarian, and a charismatic orator. His political savvy as a premier proved less immaculate, as he struggled to manoeuvre a bankrupt government through a tumultuous period of internal and external crisis. Physically frail and melancholy in character, Mossadegh was something of a hypochondriac, a condition not uncommon among members of the Qajar nobility. Mocking references in the Western press to the crying Prime Minister and his eccentricities, though thoroughly biased, may well be attributed to an anxiety disorder that made him susceptible to nervous collapse and bouts of depression. Frequently bedridden, he embarked on his national crusade from under a blanket, as if it might shield him from a hostile world. His informal manner of conducting government affairs from his bed, complete with pyjamas and a white robe de chambre, became the subject of unfair ridicule. In formal attire, however, his abiding by rules of Persian etiquette and old-school courtesy made him a charming man of verve and character. Yet it was his public image of frailty and poor health that prevailed. As he once observed in conversation with Dean Acheson, the American Secretary of State, his poor health reflected the condition of his nation, which had long been battered and bruised. It is no wonder that he was destined to be written into modern Iranian history and modern Iranian psyche as a fallen hero, a virtual martyr, and a personification of his nation, which was in cosmic battle with adversarial forces. A principled and at times stubborn man, he was approaching 70 years of age when he accepted the office of premier. Like his relative, Ahmad Gavam, he belonged to Iran's bureaucratic and landowning nobility and had old family ties to the Qajar house. His Qajar title was Mossadegh al-Sultaneh, validator of the kingdom. Having lost his father at a young age, he was brought up by his mother, a matriarch who proved deeply influential to his personality and the shaping of his public career. A pageboy in Nasr al-Din Shah's court, and later a state accountant, Mostofi, a hereditary office in his family, he rose through the ranks to hold various high offices in the post-constitutional era. He observed the constitutional revolution with a mix of respect and reservation, as any nobleman of his standing would, before heading to France in 1910, followed by 3 years of studying law at Neuchâtel University in Switzerland. The experience of studying law in a modern European setting seemed to have made him a lifetime convert to constitutionalism and the rule of law. Yet, unlike many Europeanized modernists of his time, he remained truly engaged with his own culture and society. Having married into the family of the Imam Jomeh of Tehran, one of the oldest clerical families of Iran, with roots in the Safavid era, Mossadegh's somewhat unusual union seems to have helped give him a new perspective on the place of Shi'i Islam in Iranian society and traditions. It also offered him a subject for his Swiss doctoral dissertation on will and testaments and inheritance in Islamic law, a subject novel for a dissertation at the time and for a man of his background. Examining subtleties of the Shi'i legal system through the lens of modern European law helped him recognize impediments in enforcing these in a modern context. Upon his return in 1914, on the eve of World War I, he began a career of teaching and administration while publishing in Persian on such topics as capitulatory rights of imperial powers and national sovereignty. These were themes instructive in shaping his political vision. By February 1921 and the rise of Reza Khan to power, Mossadegh, like many of his cohorts, probably viewed the coup as a foreign plot in the wake of the aborted 1919 agreement, to which Mossadegh had been adamantly opposed while he was still in Europe. Fearing arrest, he took refuge in Bakhtiari territory in central Fars, a move that was seen by Tehran as prelude to a rebellion. Yet, soon after the restoration of the Qajar notables, he returned to Tehran to serve in various sub-ministerial and ministerial posts. He came to accept Reza Khan as a necessary evil, though he did so with an air of condescension. He even joined a small group of like-minded statesmen and cultural figures who, in 1921, briefly took it upon themselves to educate the culturally uncouth Cossack officer. In 1922, Mossadegh briefly served as finance minister under Gavam, and in early 1923 as foreign minister under Hassan Mushiradouleh Pirniar, though in both posts he performed as a conscientious but reluctant statesman. In every post he found a perfectly convincing reason to resign, a favourite resort in the face of resistance, or perceived resistance, to his moral high ground. Aside from the vagaries of the politics of the time and undeniable causes for frustration, one cannot help but sense in Mossadegh a certain moral gratification in his ingenious ways of opting out of the system. Yet, peculiarities aside, soon Mossadegh found himself out of the government loop. Even after his courageous speech in 1925 in the Fifth Majlis against abolishing the Qajar dynasty, Mossadegh survived as a deputy in the next two sessions of the Majlis, and on a number of occasions opposed the government's reform programme. He opposed, for instance, the north-south axis of the proposed Trans-Iranian Railroad on strategic and financial grounds. Instead, he favoured a cheaper road network and a northwest-to-southeast railroad to connect the European network through Turkey to South Asia. Though he seems to have been oblivious to the importance of the Persian Gulf's sea access, he was correct in realising the possibilities for expanding cross-border trade. On judicial reforms, he was not in favour of Davar's drastic overhaul of the judiciary. He questioned the hurried and harmful urbanisation process, and especially the mindless destruction of the city quarters, which he correctly thought injurious to the Persian urban fabric and architectural monuments. In nearly all cases, his objections were ignored, adding to his frustration with the Pahlavi westernizing process and to Reza Shah's suspicion of the outspoken deputy. Mossadegh's stance relegated him to political exile. From 1928 to 1943, for 15 years he lived the life of a recluse, sequestered in his private estate near Tehran, farming his land and fighting various illnesses. Yet seclusion did not save him from arrest and imprisonment when, in 1940, during the last phase of Reza Shah's vengeful purge of the old elite, he was detained in a remote fortress in Birjand, in southern Khorasan, for his alleged pro-German sentiments. This was after his pro-German son-in-law, Ahmad Mateen Daftari, who served as the penultimate prime minister of Reza Shah, was dismissed from office and arrested. Mossadegh's physical elimination would be almost certain were it not for the Crown Prince Mohammad Reza's intercession with his father. By 1943, when Mossadegh was elected to the 14th Majlis as a first deputy from Tehran, he was recognized as a leading voice against the mistakes and atrocities of Reza Shah's time. His was also an audible voice against undue British influence in Iranian affairs and intrigue through proxies. He objected to the failings of the post-war government and flagrant irregularities in the Majlis election. Motivated and re-energized by new political horizons, he came to view the politics of the notables as no longer viable and essentially bankrupt. Even more than Gavam and Razmara, both of whom he opposed, he was willing to align himself with the growing middle classes, who shared his high aspirations. He was quick to learn the populist politics of the post-war era, and quicker to grasp and indigenize its anti-imperialist message as it circulated throughout the non-Western milieu, from China, India, and Southeast Asia, to Africa and Latin America. In this and other respects, Mossadegh represented a new face of post-colonial leadership, pioneered by the likes of Mahatma Gandhi and later by Sukarno in Indonesia and Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt. Yet in contrast to most post-colonial leaders, Mossadegh was an anomaly. He neither rose from the underprivileged classes or the bourgeoisie, nor did he entertain revolutionary views at the outset of his career. Oil crisis and political reform. From the start of his premiership in April 1951, Mossadegh's agenda was set with an almost heroic fervour. He had come to office to implement the oil nationalisation as his prime objective, an aspiration that, despite a popular mandate, was soon to face opposition from many quarters, from Britain, which was fundamentally against it, from the Tudeh, which still advocated a northern oil concession to the Soviet Union, and soon from the Shah and Conservatives, and eventually from Mossadegh's own allies in the Majlis and the National Front. Soon after he officially declared the nationalisation in May 1951, in a public address from Radio Iran in June, he summed up the motives behind the decision. "Long years of negotiations with foreign countries have thus far yielded no results. With the oil revenue, we can meet our entire budget and combat poverty, disease, and backwardness among our people. By eliminating the power of the British company, that is AIOC, we would also eliminate corruption and intrigue, by means of which the internal affairs of our country have been influenced. Once this tutelage has ceased, Iran will achieve its economic and political independence." High hopes for oil nationalization as key to economic sovereignty, prosperity, material development, and an end to foreign intervention remained at the core of Mossadegh's agenda throughout his term in office. In the same address, he restated the need for compensation, which the nationalisation law passed by the Majlis had set at 25% of Iran's net profits from oil production in order to cover AIOC's legitimate claims and ownership of the oil installations. Mossadegh also denied any intention to expel the British technical staff employed in the oil industry. To achieve this, he had to cross a treacherous course. His first cabinet, chosen hastily, consisted of a mix of conservative generals, devout nationalists, and old-hand bureaucrats, no doubt to balance the diverse constituencies whose support he hoped to muster. During the 26 months he was in power, he repeatedly reshuffled his cabinet, 5 changes of ministers of the interior in the first 10 months, a record even for Iran's turbulent politics of the time. His non-cabinet appointments were no more stable. Within the Majlis, support for his programme and its implementation also dwindled. Even if such instability was in part the outcome of the semi-revolutionary climate Mossadegh inherited, or intrigue from domestic and foreign quarters, he also contributed to it. Despite lofty objectives, his managerial flaws, aggravated by illness, anxieties, and obstinacy, never allowed him to fully grasp the reins of power. Instead, these paved the way for his eventual downfall, which he anticipated himself with an air of fatalism almost from the start. Yet he seemed to thrive in the environment of confrontation, as if political idealism brought out the best of his public performances. At the outset, nationalization went ahead with an overwhelming public mandate and with the Majlis support. Mossadegh emerged as the hero of dispossession, Khal-e-Yad, as the takeover of the oil industry from British control came to be known. After an angry exchange of notes with the AIOC, soon an Iranian team was dispatched to the heart of the British oil operation in Abadan to hoist the Iranian flag over the oil refinery. To AIOC's surprise, Iranian technicians and a few engineers who were assigned to Khuzestan were able to manage the oil industry's day-to-day operations. Yet, with limited experience in oil exploration and refining, it soon became apparent that they needed time and cooperation to master the managerial skills and the technical know-how that were jealously guarded by the British company. Despite Mossadegh's public assurances, AIOC quickly withdrew its entire staff, and the Iranian government's call for British employees to resume work in the nationalized industry remained unheeded. Under the shadow of British warships harbored at Abadan, the British government soon evacuated nearly all its nationals. It also put Royal Air Force squadrons in Cyprus on full alert to support the anticipated naval takeover of the oil installations. Outraged by Iranian action, the British government also lodged complaints with the International Court of Justice at The Hague, demanding that Iranian oil nationalization be declared illegal and thus void under international law. In response, Iran lodged its own counterclaims and sent representatives to defend its case. The Iranian oil nationalization thus rapidly developed into an international crisis, with important security and strategic repercussions that soon invited US intervention. At the time, Iran supplied more than 20% of the world's total oil production, and the imminent cutoff of such a vital source threatened to disrupt the Western economies that were coming out of the post-war recession. Yet the American mediation, headed by President Harry Truman's emissary, Averill Harriman, 1891 to 1986, proved ineffective. Wary of British sincerity, Mossadegh's government turned down the proposal for a 50-50 profit-sharing proposed by the Americans. Mossadegh and his advisers were legitimately concerned with many provisions and hidden clauses that such a proposal had made in favour of the British company. Torn between loyalty toward Britain, its most important ally, and support for a country long abused by European powers, the Truman administration seemingly was not prepared to press its case any further. Public demonstrations organized by the Tudeh Party against the American goodwill mission and the ensuing clashes with the mounted police in front of the Majlis resulted in 10 fatalities and many injured. By September 1951, as Anglo-Iranian relations further deteriorated, the British government took its case to the UN Security Council. To contest the British claim, Mossadegh was prompted to travel to New York as the head of a large delegation, a move designed not only to press Iran's case, but also to draw support in the United States and from the international community. A warm reception by the American public was promising, even before Mossadegh's passionate speech at the Security Council reiterated Iran's position that the dispute with AIOC was an internal affair and outside the jurisdiction of both the Security Council and the International Court of Justice. Mossadegh's speech was couched in a proficient legal language. To further pressure Iran, in September 1951, the British government imposed a full maritime embargo on the export of Iranian oil. A few customers who were willing to purchase Iranian oil were quickly scared off, and with equal rapidity, the shortage in demand was filled by increased production of the Iraq Petroleum Company, a subsidiary of AIOC, and of other Persian Gulf oil fields in Kuwait and Dubai. Initial impact aside, the long-term effect of the embargo on the British market was minimal. Yet its effect on the Iranian economy was substantial throughout Mossadegh's premiership. Issuing national government bonds to compensate for the loss of income could barely avert a financial crisis. A later increase in the volume of currency issued by the Mossadegh government only intensified the inflationary trend. It became apparent that nationalization, though a brave move expressive of national sentiments, was a formidable task, if not an untenable one. By early 1952, oil production had come to a complete standstill, for the first time since 1909, threatening with bankruptcy the government that aimed to liberate Iran from the yoke of economic hegemony. In the coming months, more battles were to be fought in the streets, in the majlis, at negotiating tables with AIOC and with American negotiators, in international forums, with the Shah and army, and even within the ranks of the National Front. Riding on Mossadegh's popularity and feeding on Iranians' bitter memories of foreign interventions, the national movement, Nahzat-e-Milli, as the oil nationalization campaign came to be known, appeared triumphant. Mossadegh was a national hero, the likes of whom Iran had rarely seen. A civilian rather than a military man, an articulate member of the nobility, but also a fatherly figure with genuine compassion for ordinary folks, and, though physically weak, determined and morally upright. Evidently willing to settle the oil issue in a reasonable fashion, he nevertheless was committed to restore the rights of the nation, a quandary that was not eased by the AIOC's highly vindictive attitude, the British government's resolve to destroy Mossadegh almost from the start, the vagaries of the Cold War, and the treacheries of Iran's domestic politics. By early 1952, his opponents began to close ranks. On the left, the Tudeh party portrayed him as a landowning aristocrat and an American agent and demagogue, while labelling the nationalisation of oil as a backdoor entry for American economic imperialism. Even though a socialist splinter, which seceded from the Tudeh party in 1948, and later came to be known as Niruye Sevom, Third Force, joined the National Front and supported Mossadegh, the Tudeh leadership and its press, loyal to the Soviet party line, did not. Through its frequent rallies in the capital and provinces, Tudeh presented itself as the party of the oppressed and underprivileged. It was not only against the monarchy and Western interests, but also against Mossadegh's crumbling bourgeois liberalism. Counter-demonstrations by supporters of the National Front, as well as by the members of the Sumkar, the Persian acronym for National Socialist Party of Workers of Iran, and supporters of Fadayan-e-Islam, often resulted in bloody clashes and crackdowns by the police and the armed forces. Sumkar was a small but openly fascist party that in every respect fashioned itself after the defunct German National Socialist Party. It advocated Aryan supremacy, engaged in thuggish street battles, and thrived on appearing militaristic, black shirt uniforms in particular, and invented racist rituals. Officially founded in 1951 by a group of Iranian Nazi sympathizers, headed by Davood Monshizadeh, 1915-1989, an SS collaborator during the war and later a professor of Iranian philology in Munich, Sumkar treated the Tudeh and the National Front as perfect targets of vocal and physical violence, much in the spirit of the Nazis. Sumkar's agitations were frowned upon by the pro-Shah security forces, but tolerated as a counterforce to the Tudeh. Mossadegh's government and its police force were too feeble to take meaningful action. The security forces were themselves a source of trouble. During Mossadegh's first term, which ended in July 1952, there were at least 10 serious cases of police crackdowns on street demonstrations, resulting in injuries and deaths. Pro-Shah officers, ambivalent about Mossadegh's abilities and critical of his alleged leniency toward the left, often headed up the police force. Social unrest and violent rallies tarnished Mossadegh's image as a well-intentioned leader inundated by enmity and intrigue. Serious fractures within Mossadegh's own ranks heightened doubts of his political survival. At its inception, the National Front, a coalition of diverse and at times opposing political groups, few could be called parties, and independent politicians, espoused oil nationalisation as its chief objective. On the left, there was Hezb-e-Zahmatkeshane Iran, Party of the Toilers of Iran, itself a merger of nationalists of the left, headed by Mozaffar Baghaei, and the socialist Niruye Sevom, headed by Khalil Maliki, 1903-1969, a German-educated academic, an articulate theoretician of socialism, and a man of political integrity. The third force included a number of intellectuals and activists of the younger generation who were disillusioned with the Tudeh subservience and dogmatic line, and by its totalitarian structure. Among them was Jalal Ali Ahmad, 1923-1969, later an influential author and social critic. At the centre was the Iran Party, dominated by liberal nationalists, including Al-Ahyar Saleh, Karim Sanjabi, Gholam Hossein Sadeghi, and Hossein Fatemi. They were Mossadegh's close allies and shared his vision of liberal nationalism. Hossein Fatemi, 1917-1954, a close advisor to Mossadegh and one of the founders of the National Front, was a firebrand editor of the influential newspaper Bakhtare Emruz, Today's West, the unofficial organ of the National Front. Later, as Minister of Affairs and spokesman in Mossadegh's last cabinet, he was among the harshest critics of the Shah and the royal court, and a supporter of republicanism. His stance against Fadayan-e-Islam's intrusion into the political realm, which nearly cost him his life, did not deter him from steering Mossadegh's political course toward greater radicalism, much to the disgust of British and the American diplomats and negotiators. Adding to the volatile mix was Fadayan-e-Islam, which soon concluded that, contrary to their earlier wishes, Mossadegh was not their man and had no intention of enforcing the Sharia as law of the land, let alone laying the ground for an Islamic government. Nawab-e-Safavi, who openly aspired to establish the caliphate, soon found himself in prison during most of Mossadegh's premiership. As the oil dispute heated up and the stakes got higher, other allies of Mossadegh, such as Baghaei and Maki, gradually abandoned him. Some switched to the Shah's camp, others abstained from taking sides, and others openly criticised the Premier on the issues of oil negotiation, its disastrous outcome, and what appeared to be his increasingly authoritarian conduct. His critics viewed Mossadegh's struggle in the face of foreign and domestic opposition as quixotic, but few could propose a way out of his political quagmire. By mid-1952, it was as if he had exhausted most of his options and was ready for an honourable exit. Yet the oil dispute was one issue that kept the Premier going in his arduous crusade. As he repeatedly confessed to his allies and foes, full implementation of oil nationalisation at any price was the single most important mission, perhaps the only mission, of his premiership. In addition to legal claims lodged with the International Court of Justice, the British threatened military intervention in the Persian Gulf. The United States came to realise sooner than Britain that, given Mossadegh's popularity, any direct confrontation with his government was unwise, illegal, and would most likely fail. Thinking within a Cold War frame of reference, the Americans advised that if Mossadegh was to be removed from power, there was a chance that Iran would fall into the hands of the communists. The British opted to procrastinate in the hope that the transient nature of Iranian politics would soon put Mossadegh out of office and open the way for a more pliant successor, such as the Anglophile Zia-ud-Din Tabatabai. The Shah, sensing that the political climate was in favour of Mossadegh and oil nationalisation, was not yet prepared to take part in an overt move against his premier. Simmering for some time, however, were deep disagreements between them that were bound to boil over soon. He nursed a suspicion that Mossadegh, a member of Qajar nobility and a long-time critic of his father's rule, was contemplating an end to the Pahlavi monarchy in favour of a republic. Anxieties translated into frequent clashes, while still maintaining proper etiquette, not only over military and ministerial appointments, but also over where Mossadegh's government was heading. The Shah viewed his premier as a political maverick and his personality as bold but unbalanced. Confrontation with Britain and engaging in street politics, the Shah believed, is bound to result in economic ruination and possibly even a communist takeover. A majority of the old elite, the higher ranks of the army, majority of the senior ulama, and businessmen who suffered from economic stagnation shared his perspective. Mossadegh's political independence and his subtle patronizing attitude toward the Shah, despite expressions of utter loyalty, did not help to ameliorate the Shah's fears. Mossadegh harbored his own misgivings. In earlier years, he had not disfavored the young Shah as a constitutional monarch, even though he remained apprehensive toward most members of the royal family, especially the Shah's twin sister, Ashraf Pahlavi, 1919-2016, whom he viewed, perhaps with an air of misogyny, as the source of intrigue and conspiracy. By 1949, however, the Shah's newly acquired power to dissolve the Majlis at will alarmed Mossadegh. With the army's higher ranks mostly loyal to the Shah, especially after Asmara, and with the Conservatives closing ranks behind him, the Shah appeared to Mossadegh and his allies as a serious obstacle to the democratic process, and even more to the successful fruition of the nationalization campaign. The Shah received the attention, if not the confidence, of the Americans, and maintained his ties with the British both through diplomatic channels and by means of informal contacts. As differences hardened over policy and over appointments, Mossadegh began to point fingers at the Shah not only for meddling in the affairs of the government and for sabotage in the Majlis, but also for fraternizing with his foreign foes. A revolution in the making. By the time of the election of the 17th Majlis in January 1952, Mossadegh's government had begun to experience major obstacles on all fronts. Oil negotiations reached a deadlock, largely because the British were procrastinating in hopes of a favourable vote of the International Court of Justice. The Iranian public, loyal to Mossadegh, anticipated a rapid victory, even though the deputies of the Majlis had increased their attacks on the government's performance. A victim of his own rhetoric, Mossadegh could hardly comply with any settlement short of full control of the oil industry, while Britain, concerned with its own imperial prestige, was in no mood to recognize nationalization as a sovereign right of the Iranian nation. Any compromise on Mossadegh's side would have prompted the swelling ranks of his opponents to accuse him of betrayal, or worse, of being an agent of the foreign powers, a charge that Mossadegh had leveled at many of his own detractors. The election of the 17th Majlis was in shambles. In Tehran, the electorate of about 140,000 returned to the Majlis all 12 candidates of the National Front, a victory that inevitably raised the suspicion of Mossadegh's opponents, such that they accused him of fixing the results. In the other pro-National Front constituencies outside Tehran, favourable candidates were also elected. Yet, having realised that not all provincial results would be favourable to him, and would therefore relegate the National Front to a minority, Mossadegh simply suspended the election and allowed the 17th Majlis to be convened with a mere 85 deputies out of the total of 136. The pretext that if elections were held in anti-National Front constituencies, they would be rigged by his opponents, could be interpreted only as political manoeuvring, and, in fact, went down on Mossadegh's record as his first constitutional breach. In due course, even the 85-member chamber proved increasingly critical of Mossadegh. In mid-July 1952, Mossadegh was still popular enough to receive a vote of confidence from the Majlis. 65 voted for him, and 19 abstained. Armed with parliamentary support, in a private audience with the Shah 10 days later, he demanded for himself a full delegation of defence responsibilities, including control of all promotions, retirements, and appointments in the armed forces. The Shah adamantly resisted on the grounds that he, not the Premier, was head of the executive branch and responsible for army appointments. The crisis was rooted in contested readings of the Constitution and its ambiguous definition of the monarch's power. Was the Premier a mere enforcer of the monarch's wishes, or, as head of the government, designated by the legislature, was he responsible for all affairs of the state? This was a question unresolved in the text of the 1906 to 1907 Constitution. Deeper down, the dispute reflected the ancient tension between the royal court, Dargah, and the Divan, which for centuries upset the Iranian state. When the Shah refused to comply, Mossadegh submitted his resignation and returned home. For a moment, it seemed as if his term of office were over, along with his hopes for oil nationalization. The Shah instantly appointed in his stead Ahmad Gavam, who had returned to the political arena after an absence of 5 years. The Shah's many grievances against the shrewd aristocrat aside, the appointment aimed to lessen political unrest and help resolve the oil crises. Gavam's record as a skilled manoeuvrer persuaded the Shah, the British and the Americans, and the conservative establishment to opt for the veteran statesman, who now promised to resolve the oil crisis and restore law and order. Yet two independent developments completely changed the climate against Gavam and in favour of Mossadegh, a turning point that shifted Iran's politics toward a more radical course. The news of victory at the International Court at Hague came 4 days after Gavam's appointment on July the 17th as the new premier. Though on July the 19th the Majlis gave its vote of confidence for the new premier, Gavam's premiership met with spontaneous mass resistance. His promise that he would take a series of draconian measures to quell unrest, end the undue intervention of the clergy in politics, especially of Kashani, and bring the oil crisis to a conclusion, outraged a wide-ranging sector of the public still supportive of Mossadegh. Street rallies in the capital and provinces on July the 21st, 1952, which came to be known as Siyeh Tir, or 30th of the month of Tir 1331 of the Persian solar calendar, perhaps the largest Iran had ever witnessed at the time, soon turned violent. Clashes with the police resulted in dozens of deaths and hundreds of injuries. The troops and tanks stationed in sensitive locations throughout the capital fired at the angry crowd. Even in Baharistan Square, in front of the Majlis, despite protests by deputies of the National Front, the troops continued aiming at demonstrators. The riots made strange bedfellows. Members of the Tudeh party, together with Sumkar and the Fadayan-e-Islam, attacked government buildings and beat troops and police officers. The call for the return of Mossadegh to power displayed overt support for him and was a clear setback both for the 77-year-old Gavam, who immediately resigned on July the 22nd, and for the Shah, who quickly reappointed Mossadegh to office. The Shah also succumbed, resentfully, to Mossadegh's demand for control over the military. The street slogan, "We sacrificed our lives, we write with our blood, either death or Mossadegh," voiced by ordinary people, saw in Mossadegh not merely a political leader, but a saviour of the Iranian nation. Mossadegh's victory was a serious blow to British and American hopes to see a compromising premier in his place. Both powers had actively sought out Gavam and backed him as an alternative to a coup or direct military action. Moreover, the July the 21st uprising displayed the power of the urban lower and middle classes as a counterforce to the politics of the elite. This was a victory for Mossadegh, who mustered such sentiments despite the Tudeh party's long-standing claims to be the party of the masses. Though Tudeh leadership still criticised Mossadegh, during the uprising its rank and file embraced the national movement en masse, with Mossadegh as their leader. If a further providential sign was needed, it came with the news of Iran's victory at The Hague on the same day, July the 21st, 1952. The ICJ agreed with Iran that the court lacked jurisdiction in the Iranian oil dispute since AIOC was a non-state entity operating under an Iranian license. Therefore, the court could not hear the case, as the British government had urged. This was the position initiated by Karim Sanjabi, 1904-1995, a French-educated lawyer and a loyal member of Mossadegh's inner circle, who was a member of the delegation representing Iran in the court. The chief lawyer hired by Mossadegh's government, the Belgian Henri Rollin, skillfully argued Iran's case. In June 1952, Mossadegh himself attended the final court sessions to personally present Iran's case and offer moral support to the defense team. The vote was perhaps the most constructive international victory for Mossadegh and his allies, having reversed the International Court of Justice's earlier injunction and vindicated the position Iran had taken all along. With a public mandate and the vote of the International Court of Justice, Mossadegh stood to gain an unprecedented advantage, and he was quick to exploit that in hopes of implementing his reform agenda beyond oil nationalization. Despite stiff resistance in the Majlis, including from his own National Front allies, he pushed through legislation that delegated to him an unprecedented 6 months of full legislative power, amounting to rule by decree. Even before the end of the six-month period on August 11, 1952, Mossadegh had succeeded in extending the delegation of power for another year, a move that was possible only through backdoor deals and reliance on street support. The virtual suspension of the legislature by a man who had built his career on defending the Constitution and legislative independence not only was ironic, but also contentious, if not entirely unconstitutional. Resort to rule by decree, however, seemed unavoidable, at least at the juncture where Mossadegh found himself after July the 21st, when he became increasingly concerned with the mischief of the royal court and even the possibility of an army coup. Moreover, the Majlis, during most of its recent sessions, had proved a quarrelling and rambunctious body with scores of demagogic and fraudulent deputies. It was a body with wide-ranging powers over the executive, and it often abused those powers with impunity. In the polarised climate of the time, if any government aimed at serious reforms, it would have found it a daunting task to pass legislation through the Majlis. Yet Mossadegh, when he was a Majlis deputy, vehemently denied any outright delegation of power to the executive branch. Most recently in the case of Razmara, when he asked for far less delegation of power to renegotiate the oil concession, Mossadegh and his allies called him a traitor, an agent of British and American imperialism, and as a generalissimo entertaining dictatorial aspirations in the style of Reza Khan. To his credit, Mossadegh employed his extraordinary powers to carry out a series of urgent reform measures, which he had promised in the programme of his second government and mostly arose from the oil crisis. These included purging the army and the administration of corrupt elements, what amounted to eradicating Mossadegh's opponents, balancing the budget through higher taxation, and reforming election laws. Yet, in reality, the sum total of Mossadegh's second government included measures that could least be justified by Mossadegh's own moral standards and legal principles. In November 1952, the Law of Social Security, Amniyat-e Ejtemai, vastly extended the power of the state to detain and prosecute individuals and organizations at the expense of the most basic civil rights. On pain of exile and threat of imprisonment, dismissal, and financial penalties, the law banned most forms of civil disobedience, demonstrations, strikes, and expressions of political dissent. The enforcement of martial law throughout nearly all of Mossadegh's second term further tarnished the image of a man who had been hailed as defender of constitutional liberties. No less problematic was reform of the press laws. It goes without saying that the behaviour of the press all through the period was often egregiously reckless, if not criminal, with frequent cases of calumny and personal vendettas, absence of journalistic ethics, and plenty of ideological bias and outright lies. Yet, imperfect as the press was, it still was the most influential forum for political debate and expression of dissent, especially since the airwaves were fully controlled by the state. Criticising all sources of power and influence, the ministers, Majlis deputies, the royal court and the Shah, and the proxies of foreign powers, it was a thorn in the side of all governments of the period. The new regulations, however, made such functions ever more formidable, if not practically impossible. The new press bill before the Majlis for ratification faced harsh criticism not only from newspaper editors and publishers who took sanctuary, Bast, inside the Majlis, but also from among some of the most ardent former supporters of Mossadegh. With little hesitation, Mossadegh's government, with himself occupying the post of Minister of Defence, undertook a widespread purge of army officers suspected of hostility toward the national movement. By September 1952, more than 150 senior officers were forced to retire, thus adding fuel to the rampant fires of discontent among the military ranks. Angered by attacks in the press and in the majlis, more and more officers turned against Mossadegh. The officers supportive of the National Front were too few and too hesitant to counter the restive officer corps. Likewise, purges in the judiciary created serious discontent. Relying on delegated power, Mossadegh's Judiciary Reform Commission, presided over by a zealous Minister of Justice, dismissed without any set procedure close to 200 sitting judges, state attorneys, and higher-ranking officials on charges of corruption and ineptitude, despite resistance from members of the Reform Commission. The en masse dismissal of the judges of Iran's Supreme Court under the pretext of eradicating corrupt elements from the court and giving it a more Islamic face further frightened the judicial establishment, which was largely the product of reforms under Ali Akbar Davar, the celebrated minister of the early Reza Shah era. Mossadegh's more successful measures in the area of finance, labor laws, rural development, and housing, to the extent they ever were implemented, projected the image of a welfare state committed to the improvement of the standard of living and well-being of ordinary citizens. Yet, here too, a bureaucratic reform agenda, in the same vein as many state-run reform programs elsewhere, aimed to centralize services and strengthen the government's hold over the public domain. Land reform, an idea contemplated since the constitutional period, was left aside by the Mossadegh government until such time that the oil dispute was resolved. As a member of the landed nobility, Mossadegh could not have fully dissociated himself from a worldview that still considered Iran an agrarian society, governed by ancient landlord-peasant covenants. Added to the tensions caused by Mossadegh's restructuring, there was a growing level of discord with the Shah and the royal court. Mossadegh had closed down the offices of the Shah's brothers and sisters, banished Princess Ashraf to Europe on charges of conspiracy, and after July 21, 1952, had tried to rein in the Shah by strictly treating him as a constitutional monarch. As early as February 1952, the Shah appeared politically disarmed and isolated, ready to leave the country on a journey that appeared to be a prelude to his abdication, or, as some viewed it, a shrewd move to outmaneuver his premier. In either case, it did not help Mossadegh's image that he was an old Qajar aristocrat facilitating the departure of a seemingly innocuous monarch who, though ambitious and even scheming, was constitutionally the head of state. On February the 28th, when Mossadegh went to the royal palace to see the Shah off, he encountered a small but angry pro-Shah crowd, some of them the very same knife-wielding thugs, Chakokesh, who, 5 months later, on July the 21st, were hired in pro-Mossadegh rallies to set up barricades and attack the police. Fearing for his life, the premier fled the royal palace and took refuge in his own house nearby, which by then was functioning as his headquarters. Relying more on a handful of his radical ministers and advisers, such as Fatemi, and all the while fearful of his own violent removal, Mossadegh tilted even more toward a political chasm. Even his former National Front colleagues were attacking him as an extremist while being repudiated, on and off, by Kashani and his allies. Viewed as the presumed spiritual leader of the national movement, in reality Kashani relied not only on Fadayan-e-Islam and on street toughs, but also on the royal court, which he viewed as a counter to Mossadegh's excesses. Earlier, during Mossadegh's first tenure as premier, and while Kashani was serving as the speaker, the Majlis passed a bill with the utmost urgency, releasing Khalil Tahmasbi, the assassin of the former Prime Minister Asmara, a clear inference in the conduct of the judiciary condoned by Mossadegh's government. The assassin was hailed by the Fadayan as a hero and a master, and was received by Kashani at his home. Equally appalling was the passage of a bill initiated by Mossadegh's supporters that labelled Ahmad Gavam a corrupter on the earth, Mosfseddeh fil Arz, a charge in Islamic law punishable by death, and that called for the expropriation, Masadereh, of his properties. As a measure of duplicity of the Speaker of the Majlis and his rapid shift in loyalty, on the morning of July the 21st, while rioters were denouncing Gavam on the streets of the capital, Radio Iran was broadcasting Kashani's message congratulating Ghavam for his premiership. In the meantime, the angry crowd, led by thugs, looted Ghavam's house for the second time in a decade. He took refuge in Ghom, and in late July fled the country in fear of his life. The confiscated Ghavam's estate, save for a portion that is to be allocated as pension to his family, was set aside for compensation to the martyrs of the July the 21st uprising. When the newly established Iranian Senate, the second chamber of the Iranian legislature envisaged in the constitution and convened in August 1951, refused to ratify either of the above two bills, Mossadegh's supporters, with his consent, first reduced the term of the Senate from 4 years to two, and then unceremoniously dissolved the Senate altogether. The Speaker of the Senate and other senators, including Hassan Taghizadeh, declared the dissolution unconstitutional, but in the intimidating climate of the time, they seemingly had no choice but to abide. Mossadegh's supporters in the Majlis accused senators of being reactionaries, who were either appointees of the Shah or large landowners who bought their way past the ballot box to guard the status quo and their own vested interests.